You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Picture that super soft t-shirt you love sleeping in. The one that gets softer and softer the more you wear it. Now you can bring that same lived-in softness to your entire bed with Signature Vintage Wash Sheets from Boll & Branch. This all-new collection is even softer than your favorite t-shirt, with a distinctly relaxed look and feel for your best night's sleep. Just like all Boll & Branch bedding, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets start with the highest quality, 100% organic cotton. The lived-in feel comes from a small batch washing process, creating a level of softness you've never felt before. And it's not just the feel. Boll & Branch mastered the laid-back aesthetic using a special technique that creates the well-loved look you'll find with vintage jeans. And true to the Boll & Branch hallmark, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets get softer and softer with every wash. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order with promo code ODYSSEY and save on their most relaxing sheets. So head to BollAndBranch.com today. That's B-O-L-L and Branch.com.
Welcome back. Welcome in. This is Country Roads Confidential at earsports.com, part of the Paramount Podcast Network. Monday, September 12th. Neil Brown, still the head coach at West Virginia. Will be quite some time. The seat, though, quite warm now. Chris Anderson, we knew this Saturday evening. Yesterday, you maybe hope that people take a step back, catch their breath, walk the dog, go on a hike. Not necessarily what happened. The situation perhaps exacerbated by Nebraska deciding to fire its head coach. Parallels maybe exist. Others do not. I do find that's a dynamic that's going to stir this drink a little bit quicker than it was already. But here we are 2 days later, and then really 2 weeks from a game that could mean a lot or may ultimately mean nothing for Neil Brown. Odd times in Morgantown.
Very odd. I'm trying to think of the last time it's happened, and I don't think it's happened since I've been doing this. I've been doing this since 2010, 2011. You've been doing it longer than me, so you have a little more experience. I mean, in general, but you have more experience with this angle than I do. But, you know, we always talk about some of these other guys like in the industry when we talk to guys on the network and how they're going through coaching changes. I mean, our Tennessee guys, I think, went through like 4 coaching changes in 6 years, it felt like. But as far as West Virginia's goes, you know, what has been my experience with a bad season? There was, what was that, 2013 with Dana? That's been about it. I mean, there's been a lot of mediocre seasons, disappointing seasons, but not just flat out, oh my God, what's happening, except for 2013. And I think that was kind of expected with the whole quarterback carousel before the year. And it was like, that never works. And then the coach, even when it came down to Dana leaving, the coaching search lasted, what did we say, 4 days, 5 days, and then it was done. So this is not new territory for us, but certainly, as you noted, strange days in Morgantown, strange days for WVU fans. An entire generation probably hasn't had to deal with something like this before.
Let me just give you like a quick run through on these situations here. For one, I've written about this, talked about this before. One of my favorite things in sports is watching a coach lose it. Like, you just know that it's going to go bad before it ever gets better. And then you see things that happen. Like, I remember one famously was when Brady Hoke was in trouble at Michigan, and like, he sent his quarterback out there concussed. That's unfortunate, don't get me wrong, but you're just like, what in the world? And you can just tell that guys lose grip on everything because their world is crumbling in around them. I don't know that that's happening here yet. They lost to Kansas and they're 0-2, but they lost to a ranked Pitt team before that. It's not good. Listen, if you haven't been 0-2 since before the stadium you play in was built, that's not good. But when coaches are on the hot seat, they begin to act differently. Their players hear the noise, and frequently a team is just going to give up. And obviously, 2 games in, that hasn't happened yet. To think that it's like completely finished already, there may be warning signs. I think you can match up some things that you've seen and heard, and just like maybe a history of 3+ seasons now that I don't know, would overlap with coaches who've lost their jobs. This to me is there are a lot of comps to the end for Bill Stewart when he was in charge here, except he was winning 9 games. I don't know if they're going to get the 9 games this year, which means that Brown hasn't been to 9 games ever as the West Virginia coach. So I'm not even sure that's a good parallel. My point being is, like, past is prolonged, people like to say, maybe not necessarily here. I do know that, like, people were really ready to cut on Bill Stewart fast because of the Colorado and East Carolina losses. And this is a team that was on the cusp of a national title. He takes over, and all of a sudden, it didn't take long for things to go bad quickly for them. I don't know if that fits here. So maybe the most recent time that West Virginia has been through it is not the most useful comparison point here. So much has changed. The decision makers, the money involved, the urgency perhaps to make a change, the entire coaching market. There's so much urgency now, too, that you do see a program like Nebraska make a move. You and I were talking, Chris. It doesn't make a lot of sense to make a move right now. And also, people are going to hate this, but, like, they're not so far away from being 1-1 or, I don't know, even 2-0. Trouble is that a lot of the problems that cost them one or both those games have been problems for a couple years. And the solutions that you might need to get yourself out of this are not things they've been able to summon before, or perhaps are able, supposed to summon before this season started. And it doesn't seem like it's there, too. So while it is early, this could be a long road.
Could be a very long road. Yeah, like you said, you and I were talking right before we got on here about questions of people saying, why isn't West Virginia going ahead and firing? And we talked about it immediately after the game on the podcast, that what's the point right now? What's going to happen right now? Who are you going to put in charge? You're still paying the money no matter what for the rest of the year. You're still paying the same amount to Neil Brown if you fire him right now, if you fire him 6 weeks from now, if you fire him a year from now. So money's not the issue. It's a question of what's best for the program this year and in the future. You cut ties right now. Again, one, who are you putting in charge? A lot of questions around that. I threw out the candidates, Chad Scott, Matt Moore, I think both have elevated titles in their names. Coordinators are Graham Harrell, who just got here a few months ago, Jordan Leslie. And, you know, Jordan Leslie, I think, might have been the most likely candidate if you had asked me 2 months ago. Like, if Neil Brown had to step away for whatever reason, who would step in? He might have been somebody I would have seriously considered. But now the defense is the problem. Do you put the guy who's in charge of the problem in charge of the whole team? That might not sit well with a lot of people. So it's going to be a process. It's not going to be something that's resolved in the next 48 hours. I think it's going to be something it's going to take a couple weeks, couple months, as they try to feel this out and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, so be careful. You got to really watch where you step when you're trying to get information here. Be careful who you trust, who you listen to, who you read, who you watch, because people are going to try to get a foot in the door here, the information, and leverage the situation toward themselves here. And the reality is that you're probably going to hear a lot of stuff, and there might be degrees of truth. Some of it, there could be things going on, who knows? But for the time being, I would be very surprised. Well, one, I'd be surprised if you heard anything from West Virginia. Not sure I agree with that, but you might have to just accept that too, because the best thing they can do is try to remember it is 2 out of 12. And the only way they salvage this is to try to get it together and win. And you'd rather fail trying than fail abandoning, I think. There's probably some logic to that. You know, you could fail because, hey, we gave it a shot. And for every reason you just make, Chris, it financially doesn't give you any advantage. Or even strategically doesn't give you any advantage to go out and make a change right now or after 2 more losses. Who knows? But you can redeem this somehow. I mean, you can get yourself to a bowl game. You could pull off some sort of run. All of a sudden, cooler heads prevail and the team does better. We'll see. I think we know what we're going to talk about today in the Q&A portion of our podcast, Chris. Probably no reason for us to continue on here. What do you say that you ask some tough questions, Chris?
Yeah, I'll get started. I'm going to go quick fire because did you see the comment on Twitter after the game? I mean, there are a million.
Probably not.
But I asked everybody on Twitter, how long should you and I shoot for the post-game podcast? And one response was, aim for 30 minutes, then decide to cut yourselves off at 45. and that person listens to the pod. He knows what we're like. So we're not shooting for 30. We might not cut at 45, but let's get started. And I'm going to start us with quick fire. And Mike, these are going to be legit quick fire.
All right.
You got to answer quickly, or if you don't want to answer, I chime in and answer it as well. We'll try to make it short, like, you know, a couple sentences a piece or something like that, 30 seconds a piece, because I got a handful of quick fire, and then we got a handful that, you know, we'll go a little deeper on, because not surprisingly, I think last week set the record for most questions asked in the post-game Q&A, and then this week broke it. So here we go. First question of the quick fire from 23 years. Did the way in which Brown commented on / praised Kansas leading up to the game come across as preemptive excuse-making to you?
In hindsight, it looks bad. Combine that with that video from The Office when they had lost a pit and they were like, yeah, we're good, by the way, don't give up. That's unnerving. I just thought that the praise was over the top for a team that's supposed to be veteran and able to handle itself. So, yeah, that concerns me.
I am... originally chalked it up as, yeah, he says something nice about every single team, but it did seem a little over the top for Kansas at the time. So, yeah,
by the way, very accurate, though.
Yeah. Yes. Wicked Jester, over under 20,000 fans in the stands next week against Towson.
Over. Baltimore is a short car ride, and the Tigers are 2-0.
Over as well. I believe the lowest home attendance, at least I was going back year by year trying to check, was 31,000, 32,000, and that was at the tail end of the of a bad year against, I think that was 2013, and it was against Iowa State, I think, at home, and that was 31,000. I know that's Iowa State and this is Towson, but I think you're going to get somewhere probably around that number. I think the question is it going to be over under 30,000? Might be more a tougher line to pick here.
That's bad, by the way. That's bad. Rapid fire, I know, but that's bad. If they're under 40, that's bad.
Yes. We can extend it a little bit. I mean, if you're announcing half capacity, that's bad. Like, I don't know any other way to put it. Like, you can't, because I think we all know that sometimes the numbers that are announced may be a little bit inflated. Some places inflate more than others, but I think West Virginia usually does a pretty decent job of getting accurate numbers released for attendance. What they say, 52,000 for the Kansas game. You know, they didn't try to inflate it and say it was a sellout. But if they announce 30,000, 29,000, that's, things are tough right there.
Yeah, that's a metric that's used for sure. The attendance, the spikes, the drops, season tickets, so on and so forth. Yeah, if in week three before September is over, you're getting half your stadium full, it's hard to fill it back up.
Yeah. West Virginia Rugger, would you recommend golf or hiking as alternative to watching West Virginia football this fall? Must pick one. I'm a 20 handicap with one new hip and the other is a banana peel. Mike?
Personally, hiking, because golf would make me as mad as watching my team lose.
That's a good point. I felt like the answer was definitively golf, because you're still basically doing the hiking, except you also have a sport. But yeah, then you're just going to make you're trying to avoid being angry, and then you're just going to go out there and make yourself angry. So maybe Mike's already convinced me to change my mind. So good quick fire answer, Mike. Tater316, at that moment in time, did you think Kansas should have gone for it on 4th and 1 with 3 minutes left instead of punting?
Yeah, so I was on my way to the media room, and I was listening to the ESPN Plus, which was a treat, by the way. It got very frantic on the air, it sounded like, including West Virginia scoring a touchdown. They're down by 2, and the woman goes, do they have to go for 2 here? Yes.
Yeah, well, and I felt like, daggone, I can't believe that tweet's out there from me, because for the first quarter, Forrest Connolly was the analyst, former lineman for Florida State, and he had some great stuff in there early on with some of the plays that were going on, and I was like, man, we need more offensive linemen as analysts. I feel like he's bringing a different perspective than the typical quarterback look at this game, and that was his peak. about 5 minutes into the first quarter.
Okay.
Once we got into that fourth quarter and the conversations you're talking about right now, I was like, man, that was a bad take by me from the first quarter.
Yeah. And I didn't mean to be derogatory by saying the woman. I just cannot remember her name. But she said, definitely, do they need to go for two here? Yeah, they do. So anyhow, on my way down, it's fourth, whatever. And then I'm like, well, what they'll probably do is try to draw them off. But I have seen Kansas do the try to draw them off, go for it. And I thought that was the play. And if I heard it correctly, they tried to do that.
Yeah.
And ended up calling the timeout. If it was a 7-point game, I'm probably going for it. You're asking West Virginia to make a bunch of plays to set up a situation to make another play. So you got to make a bunch of plays to score a touchdown and then go for two. I would have probably kicked it because it just a lot has to go right. And you're saying, if you can, great. And then we have overtime at the very least. And that defense for West Virginia had not been able to stop Kansas. So I understand the calculation there. I would just probably rather punt it. And I'm the guy who thought Neil Brown probably should have gone for it against Pitt, but could certainly understand why he didn't. I can understand because Lance Leipold won why he punted it, but I kind of thought they wouldn't, and I was okay with that.
I'm going for it for the same reasons. I think West Virginia should have gone for it. I think, you know, again, you make it, game's over, period, end of story. There's no questions. There's no doubts. You don't make it. West Virginia has to do the same thing that they have to do when you punt, except just a little bit shorter field. They still have to go down. They still have to score a touchdown. They still have to get the 2-point conversion just to tie it. And yeah, you're right. They did do the, oh, we're trying to draw you off sides. Okay, let's start walking towards the sideline. And then Daniel sprinted back up under center like he was going to sneak it at the last second of the play clock. And that seemed, it was like, oh, man, he's going to QB sneak it. But it was also just another push to try to get West Virginia to jump off sides, and kudos to West Virginia's defense for something, not jumping there.
You know, as you talk me through this now, and I listen to myself, and I kind of review this in my head, I would have gone for it for all because everything
is,
I just said
is
to 8 points.
This is your thing. What makes the other team the most uncomfortable?
Yeah,
what
think so. I think
you
right
not
there.
Want you to do.
I think you're right there. Maybe I impressed myself so much by expecting the fake false start and then go for it thing. But no, the more I think about it now, I probably definitely would have gone for it because the shorter field's the only difference, and at least to get the ball back with a chance to do something.
Yeah. Next quick fire, J Carr 304. If West Virginia played Texas or Baylor yesterday, would Charles Woods have played? Was he healthy enough to play in a quote big game?
This would be very rapid. No. And I'm not certain you'll see him soon either.
Absolutely not. He would not have played, no matter who the opponent was. I don't have much more to add to that right now, but the answer is no. Next quick fire, Duffy 95. What are some good whiskeys to drink? The sorrow away until the season is over.
Whiskeys.
With some Sprite Zero?
No. See, I didn't know we were doing this one here. I thought this was a family podcast, so I didn't really research this one here. There's a lot that you can get into. Boy, are we going bourbons or just whiskeys? Bourbons usually what we talk about, right?
Yeah, usually bourbons are a thing, but I guess we just any kind of brown drink.
Is that a play on words?
I'm not. You know, I'm not that clever.
Brown liquids, so on and so forth. Where would you go here for the best whiskeys you can get yourself into? This might have to be a written portion, Chris.
We'll save it for the written portion. I'll put it back in there. I'll give my recommendations and the proper Sprite Zero and Diet Dr. Pepper matches. What's it called? The guy that's the wine specialist that knows how to pair everything.
Sommelier.
I'll know how to pair all the best brown drinks with all the best sodas for you. I know everybody loves it when I do that.
There was a bottle of Pikesville. Pretty sure it's not bourbon. Pikesville. That was at my house not long ago. It's whiskey. Very good. Top of my head. Again, not a straight whiskey guy myself, but I do know I had that, and it stuck in my head as we had this conversation now. So it must have been good.
Moving on to the next question, maybe a little, we're transitioning into the longer question, so this one can be a little longer than quickfire, but Hair Raid asks, Why does Neil Brown have a higher buyout at WVU in year four than Scott Frost does at Nebraska?
I do not know.
Okay, that's sufficient enough answer, I guess.
Just, I mean, every AD is going to do these things differently. There's no industry standard. At the same school, you're going to have head coaches for different sports. The contract negotiated by the same coach is going to be different. Agents are able to leverage certain things for certain purposes. Brown's got a good agent. A lot of college head coaches have him, including like Dabo Swinney, who just got a great new deal. His agent is well regarded, so good for him. That might be what he does when he goes into rooms and says, hey, it starts here. This is one of my clients. This is what we do. And it could have been as simple as that. I do not know his agent's history of contacts with other schools. I could probably look into that. It may be relevant, but sometimes it's just a template that an agent brings in and says, here's what we want to start, or here's how the buyout's going to work. Manipulate the numbers, but you're not going to manipulate the foundation. Shane Lyons might have been okay with it. It might have been Shane Lyons' idea, for all I know. Lots of questions that have to be answered there, I think, if it does indeed become relevant. But the one school or the other, one coach, their comparison is difficult to make because, again, there's no standard out there. It's not like a rookie scale contract in a league where everybody at a certain time in their careers or a certain age or a certain level of experience or success gets a requisite contract. It's not like that. So the variables create conversations like this.
Next question, another medium length question. Why do you think, to quote JT Daniels, dumb seems to happen at the worst possible times with this team? It happens to everyone and every team every once in a while, but we are consistently dumb. I don't get it. Coaching priorities in the wrong place. Crazy run of bad luck. J Cart 304.
It's not bad luck. Not. I mean, college football does stuff, sure, but the best answer is just discipline. It just is. And it doesn't mean that a coach doesn't stress discipline, and it doesn't mean the players don't know to do certain things, but there comes a point where, listen, this is unfair in that he is going to get named here for a game that featured him for such a small segment, but you're Traylon Davis. You're the third tight end for like a possible number of plays of maybe five in a game, right? Like maybe there's five plays in the entire playbook that require you. And one of them pops up. You cannot flinch. You just cannot. Like, your job as the person there, the 11th player on the field, the third tight end, is to block, and you absolutely cannot go in reverse. And he did, and that's a bummer. You're the backup right tackle, and you're out there because the starter is next to you, but the starting right guard is on the sideline because he can't play. You got to block the edge, and you got to make sure the pocket doesn't collapse, and you got to pull on certain plays and pin on the other, all that stuff, right? But when your team has it going and you're near the goal line, you can't flinch, right? When you're Parker Groathouse and you're on scholarship and your job is to kick into the end zone, you got momentum and you got to make your defense a little bit better than it is by giving a good field position. You can't kick it out of bounds. Like, so just discipline things. Like, you've got to do the stuff that you know you're supposed to do. And it's so sports writery, I know that. But is it bad luck that those things happen? That's the worst luck in the world then, because it's happened this entire time. Like, we talk about this a bunch. And like, people get mad at us because we talk about two-minute drills and end of half or timeouts after kickoffs and all that stuff. Discipline's on the sideline too. And listen, you saw it again. I mean, they have the back-to-back penalties because they have a false start and they got to delay a game. It doesn't hurt them. They still make the field goal. They're 5 yards further back. I'm sure you can make a compelling point that that was an intentional delay of game to give the kicker a better angle on the field goal, whatever. But it was just confused in the sideline because they couldn't get things communicated and organized quickly enough to not get a delay of game penalty. You're not going to burn a timeout there. It would have been really bad if they burned the timeout. That would have been panicky to me. But you could go back and look at close losses. And Brown said turnovers. Sure. That puts a whole lot on Reese Smith and JT Daniels when a lot of the things that didn't have to happen happened. It's maybe an easy answer, but I think it's a very obvious answer in that the stuff that you know you're not supposed to do and that most of the time doesn't happen, when you're in those big situations, listen, you catch the ball, it doesn't fly through your fingers. You hit the open receiver in the end zone. You don't look at him and then pat the ball and go somewhere else. You don't jump. You don't flinch. You don't kick out of bounds. Like, you have to have the discipline to make the difference in a positive way in those situations.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Yeah, there's a couple things I want to talk about here. One is the penalty part of this. First off, last year, what if I told you that West Virginia was in the top 25 fewest penalty yards per game last year? Like, so it's not a trend, you know. It shocked me too. I thought I recalled a little more than that. But West Virginia had 43.2 penalty yards per game in the year 2021, which ranked 23rd in the nation. This year, obviously, like a lot worse. It's only two games, so you know, but they're 118th out of 130 teams in penalties per game. The problem with so many of these penalties, and it goes back to last year, it goes to this year. This year, obviously, it's pretty easy to kind of point to them. Last year, don't have it off the top of my head. We can go back and look, but I don't know if I need to go back and do all the research like I did for the timeout thing, which went over so very well.
Yeah.
But think about the penalties that West Virginia had in these games. False start. You know, first and goal at the five, false start, fourth and goal from the 1 foot line, the roughing the passer. After these are mental mistakes. These aren't, I was blocking someone 10 yards downfield and accidentally my right hand went 6 inches to the right and got outside his shoulder pad, so they caught holding. This isn't, I jumped a split second too early to break up a pass and they called pass interference. This is just mental mistakes that are happening with this West Virginia football team. And yeah, that raises questions. Why? Why is it happening? And some of them, and related to and specifically looking at this Traylon Davis play, you noted he's only there for a handful of plays. You can't mess up on a handful of plays. My counter here is why in the most key positions, the key parts of the game, the key plays of the game, are you bringing in a redshirt freshman that has not played a single snap all game? He didn't play a single snap all game. Yeah. You go look, because that was a false start, that does not technically count as a play. He is officially credited, despite being called for a false start, as not playing in that game right now. Now, I think the NCAA put him down as a participant because he got whistled for that, but he officially has zero snaps in that game. That was the only time he stepped on the field, according to Pro Football Focus. And that kind of takes me to a thing of if you go back and look, how often is this happening where it's guys that are making mistakes that are coming in or in new spots or playing limited roles that are coming in key positions? Because it was something that actually worked out last year on some plays. I remember specifically we talked about Reese Smith. I think it was it last year or the year before where –
both.
I think he played like 10 snaps, but like the 10 snaps in one of those games was like four third and shorts and fourth and shorts, and they were throwing to him. And it's like, why? And again, recent in the first game against Pittsburgh, you know, I think he was targeted once for like 1 yard, and then he is the guy you're targeting on the final play of the game. In this game against Kansas, Justin Johnson, the third down running back for West Virginia, zero touches in the first half. Might have been zero snaps, period, at least on offense. Zero. And then he is the guy that you're giving the ball to down two scores in the fourth quarter running the ball to your third down running back who didn't play at all in the first half. Like, it, those are the things that, you know, when the questions are asked, are these mental, are these bad looks? It's, what was the old say? Was it Dale Royal? You know, luck doesn't go around looking for a stumble bum. You have to be in position for it. I might have reversed that, but it's, you put yourself in position to have good luck or bad luck. And I feel like some of this stuff, you can call it bad luck, but West Virginia is putting themselves in a position to have bad luck.
Yeah, when you create the small margin, you've got to be extra careful. And the team that creates that margin has not been able to manage it.
Moving on to questions from Luke Zoolander 01. As you can tell, we're obviously getting to the longer answer portion of the podcast. Luke's got three questions here. I think all three of them are worth answering here on the pod. So we'll go one by one. Number one, if you were a coach, actually, God, we got five, I guess, because number one has three separate parts too. So one A, if you were a coach, give us your starters at corner and safety, assuming that Woods is out. Mike, you making any changes to the lineup right now?
I mean, I was surprised that McCormick had the best PFF grade.
Same.
But I didn't like what I saw the first game, and I don't like what I saw from the defense in the second game, and I just don't know what I have with Benoit Hodden spells. I would have a hard time running McCormick out there again. And Ajay wasn't terrific either. By the way, I did go back and I re-listened to Brown. I was in the room after the game he was talking, but I'm also going through a lot of things in the post game. He did say that the players just kind of cooked themselves in some of the coverages and they did not play what they were supposed to play. That's the point I brought up in the post game podcast. Like, I'd be very curious to see if they were instructed to bail on third and medium and give the receivers the sticks. My point being, I suspect that was not the instructions they were given. And that's pretty much what Brown said, stuff they never did. They did during the game. That can't happen. And like, that has to come with a penalty, and that might be your starting spot. So that might be a Jai and it might be someone else in a bowl spots for me. At this point, it's early enough. You don't have to say what do you have to lose, but it's also early enough where you can say, what do you have to lose? Maybe you find something good. Safety. Whew. I like McLaurin a lot. I've also liked Aubrey Burks a lot. I believe Burks got injured, correct?
I don't know if he got injured, but I was thinking the same thing. I was surprised at his grade being just average because I thought he was solid. I thought he was very good.
McLaurin.
His time out there.
McLaurin, you mean?
Both of them are right around average. I thought both were solid.
Yeah, Burks and then Floyd, I just haven't seen it yet, but I can't say he's been a problem. Like, their safety play has been okay to me. They haven't tackled well, but they've had so many things spun to them because of coverage underneath that's been a problem. I would certainly strongly consider changes. I would probably keep Ajay, and I would consider spells or Benoit Hodden at the other one right now just because I haven't seen it from McCormick yet, but maybe McCormick has it. One thing is, like, I don't know who practices well because we don't get to see it, and they make these decisions based on practice, which is why Alekhai Ruppin started. It's not because he was oldest, right? He just probably had the best practices. They put him in. Can't believe that he's going to have the best practice this week because I can't believe he's going to be the guy that's in the lead position to get the one rep. So I think you'll see a change there. And then I would try to get McLaurin on the field more because he looks so fast, so athletic, so rangy. So it might be him and Burks. Now, maybe it's Floyd and McLaurin. Like, they have to do some maneuvering to make that work. But my point being, I don't know the answer except that it wasn't what you saw the first two games.
Yeah. I mean, I've been a big proponent of if one spot's not working, you have to make change. Like, you can't sit here and play favorites for too long, or it will cost you the way that it's costing you. And you have guys that, you know, do they have their flaws? Probably. Are they young and inexperienced? Yes. But like I said, what's the worst that's going to happen? You're going to give up 300 passing yards and lose to Kansas? It's already happened.
Yep.
It's already happened. So I would go out there. I would give Andrew, I mean, I don't know what happened to Andrew Wilson-Lamp. He was the starter in the spring. He long, rangy, looked decent. Like, you know, was I thinking he's going to start? No, I predicted that Ajayi or McCormick would take over the starting role opposite Woods. But I thought he'd be part of that rotation, and he has been non-existent. Zero defensive snaps through two games. Mumu Ben-Wahad, big-time player out of high school. Interested to see what he can do moving forward. And then, of course, there's Jacoby Spells, a four-star recruit who just dominated every single game. They had him play in an all-star game. He was excellent there. Like, I get that, hey, you know, oh, hey, he's not practicing that well or whatever the reason is. Put him in a game. See what happens. See what happens, because you're never going to know until you know, until you put him out there and put him on the spot. So you ask me starters, all this stuff, whatever. I don't give a, like, especially against Towson, start whoever the hell you want. But I think everybody needs to get some reps back there so you can try to figure out what you have.
Yeah. And then this Towson game comes across in a way that maybe is beneficial for them, because if not Saturday, when for some of these people, like, you have a chance to get some answers to some questions you really do need to ask. So again, if not Saturday, then when?
1B from Luke, you're too deep at wide receiver. Changed anything?
Well, you don't have a too deep because you don't have enough guys.
I was going to say.
So you have Wheaton and Bram at one spot, correct?
Yeah.
Prather and Sam James. This is backup. You have James and Aaron and Reese and James. Smith and James. So I don't know. Like, I don't know the depth is the issue there, because like, their top three guys are going to be productive and they can get enough out of Reese Smith to be, you know, a fourth. And then really Aaron and Bram are just snap fillers at five and six. So that's okay. I'm not really worried about that. Like, to think they're going to play eight's ridiculous. So you need probably four, maybe five. And I think they have enough to get to five by combining Bram and Aaron. Aaron might be okay too. Continue to hear good things about him, but their top line is fine. It might be hard to stretch him out over 12 games at 70 something snaps and like 95% of the snaps, but like, I would want Bryce Ford Wheaton on the field a bunch. I like much more what I saw from Prather than the second game in the first game. And James may just kind of be who is. He might just be who he is. You know, you may not see anything splashy from him. He might run past the guy who falls down and catch a touchdown, but he might be kind of meh the rest of it. But he's a serviceable player there. So 4 or 5, find your way there. I don't think you need it too deep there. That's not my concern in their offense or even with their performance overall so far.
Same. I'm not sure I'm changing anything either. What percentage of snaps for each of the running backs, CJ Mathis, Johnson? You change anything there?
So you did not like the call for Justin Johnson. I thought he ran better than Tony Mathis did, which means in two games, someone else besides Tony Mathis has impressed me as a runner.
Agreed.
He is not as decisive. He looks to me like a guy who wants to run like CJ Donaldson, but decides to run like Justin Johnson. And what I mean by that is, like, he's big and he's strong and he can run through and over people, but he's really picky about trying to find the hole. And if you just put the runs over top one of another, and I've done this like split screen or I guess open tabs back to back, the suddenness of a CJ Donaldson run versus a Tony Mathis run is significantly different. Like, Donaldson just gets it and goes. Like, I think Mike O'Loughlin said fearless last week, and I think it's probably a good word. Like, he's not worried about, he might bump into his left guard. Whoops, oh well. But he also might split the guard and tackle and be bearing down a linebacker. Mathis seems like he's very methodical a little bit. Not like Le'Veon Bellish, but poking around trying to find the hole and then blast through it, whereas Donaldson's just blind trust in the scheme. Just get it and go. And if you hit somebody, run it over. Mathis seems like he wants to get free before he gets going a little bit. So I don't know if it's 33, 33, 33. I'm still kind of leery about putting too much on Donaldson, but I don't know that why Mathis would have the lion's share of carries right now. The trouble is, it's so hard to get three on the field and get one of them going. So I might try to roll them all in early and then just kind of go from there based on results and the first opportunity each one gets, because quite likely it's going to be a different person every time. If I had to feature somebody, or if I had to give somebody 34%, because you can't split 100 three ways equally, I would give Donaldson a 34 because he's been the most consistent so far for me. I know he didn't have the big splashy plays against a defense that's not as good, but he generally moves forward. He can do some things in the passing game. His pass protection is okay, and he's just been the best overall performer of the group so far.
Agreed on that. Agreed on Johnson. I actually agree that Johnson looked better than Mathis. My issue is that the guy has played 8 snaps in the first game, 0 snaps in the first half, and then on the most critical plays of the game, he's out there and you're handing him the ball. I think that's, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what, it's not like you don't have something there because C.J. Donaldson is obviously doing his part. He'd only played, C.J. Donaldson only played 21 snaps on Saturday. There were 80 snaps in all. So that means, according to the snap counts here, Mathis is played over half of the game. Donaldson played about a quarter, and Johnson played a little less than a quarter. I'm not sure that's the split I want, 50-25-25. If anything, maybe 50-25-25 with Donaldson getting most of them. But I agree, you just can't push, I don't think, Donaldson up to 20 carries a game. I think you start doing that, you're going to start wearing him out, and you might see his production slip quite a bit. So let's not get carried away with that. Next part of Luke's question, what true freshman do you see as most likely for the staff to start giving PT? I think we've kind of touched on these. He mentioned Spells, Stokes, Lathan, or wide receiver. Wide receiver, no, right? Like, I think we've both agreed on that. Spells, we both agreed, yes, maybe, kind of, or at least maybe not agreed. I know I said it.
Mm-hmm.
But
Ben Wahad's a true freshman, too.
Yeah. So Stokes, Lathan, I mean, linebacker, is that an issue? I mean, I don't think it's been great play there, but who's he taking over for right now?
Well, is he going to be better than Lee Koba? I don't know, but I'm not sure how great Lee Koba's been either.
Yeah, I was going to say, can we talk about if Lee Koba's been great? Because I don't know.
Listen, it was very presumptuous to think that he was going to be Tony Fields. Like, that was kind of crazy for me. Here's a guy who played at Syracuse, but, you know, didn't. Syracuse is not like Monsters of the Midway, right? Like, if he wasn't going to get out there more, he didn't. Like, he was a good special teamer and like a backup his sophomore year. But like, this is not like a great guy who had a monster season, went to the portal and ended up at West Virginia. Detoured junior college. Good season there. Fine. But like, it's not transferable right away. It's going to take time. So there's some learning curve here that he's certainly adjusting to, and he's got to slow down and get through it. And you can see that out there. So that's not been great. And he's had to play every snap because they don't have a backup for him. Tyreek Austin-Cave is their backup. Caden Beiser isn't getting on the field. I'm not sure that Lathan's the guy, but like, could you put him out there and see what he can do? Again, if not Saturday, when? I don't know. So like, again, this game might fall into good spots. Middle linebacker is so hard for veterans to play that I'd be really surprised if a true freshman can play it. So I don't know about that one. Corner, you can. We saw Ben Wahab. Spells has pedigree. He's supposed to. Stokes, I just don't know if he's physically there yet. It's a guy who didn't do the spring and was there, but was probably not full go wide open in preseason. So that's a tough one. A name that I might watch would be Asani Redwood, though. Supposed to be good. They are missing 3 defensive linemen, at least, with Zaki Lawton, Jalen Thornton, and Hammond Russell. And he has been dressed for both the games. One on the road, one at home, has not played. And again, I don't know if this is someone that they overdescribed, and he just isn't quite there yet, but they got everybody excited because now there's an expectation that he's good and he can play. And here's a defensive line that might need a couple snaps here and there. A guy who doesn't need a redshirt, right? Why isn't he playing? Don't know. But that might be one. Like, we haven't mentioned him, but that might be a guy that gets in there to see if he can push the people around and make some plays.
Agreed. I think the Redwood one is the one I'd be watching the closest, just because outside of Spells, just because, and Ben Wahad, of course, just because of one, what you just said, they talked him up. He's a big guy. They want to rotate in. And we saw a defensive line. I don't know if they, I guess you can say they took a step back in the second game, but they were not, you know, dominant. I thought they were very good in the Pitt game, going against one of the best offensive lines in the country, and they put pressure on Pitt. They held their own in the middle there, and then against Kansas, they just didn't. They were virtual non-factors. I mean, I'm trying to think of, you know, after the game, I said, how often did we talk about a defensive back winning a one-on-one battle in the secondary? How many pass breakups? PFF gave 2. I don't remember either of them. But then you go back to the defensive line, and it's like, how often was the defensive line in the backfield and causing problems? And now the first drive or two, they were. And first drive or two, Kansas didn't score. But after that, I think the only guy I remember even being mentioned on the defensive line after those first couple drives was Sean Martin until the Austin penalty. So it's a spot that, you know, I'm not circling because, again, I was really high on it after the first game. I don't want to get too low on it after the second game. But if you're looking for more guys to get more reps, and they talk repeatedly about wanting to have 6, 7, 8, 9 guys playing, Asani Redwood might be one of those guys.
Chris, Pro Football Focus, listen, it's not for everybody can take it or leave it. And I think offensive line ratings are probably the most controversial, I guess, you know, divisive. How about that when it comes to their rankings? Pitt, pass blocking grade, 65. Run blocking grade, 119.
119?
Kansas, 12 pass blocking, 31 run blocking.
What?
Yeah.
Get out of here.
No, serious.
I'll be honest here. Like, I enjoy PFF. We use it for a lot. I think they're great 99% of the time. I wonder about the guy who did this game, the Kansas West Virginia game. I mean, they had JT Daniels with like his worst grade, I think, like of his entire career. I mean, the guy was 70-some percent completion percentage, 360 yards, 3 touchdowns. And I think, you know, only had like a couple bad throws. Obviously, the one at the end was crucial. But like, his worst game of his career was Saturday night. I'm not buying that. Come on.
What was his grade?
59.
It has been updated.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, he's 66.8 now.
Okay.
Yeah, so they've changed a few of these things. Like, for example, wait a minute. No, that's the season grade.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're looking at the same thing? No, because, yeah, 59.7 is what I see here.
Yeah, that's the season grade. My bad. It has not been updated. So, yeah, that's true. Yeah, tough one. Bookkeeping was kind of a mess in that game. Like, they just have some people who, like, they have Michael Laughlin not playing. Pretty sure Mike played.
Yeah.
Although that might explain the Traylon Davis thing if Michael Laughlin wasn't playing, but it doesn't because he did play. So, yeah, that one's a tough one. And typically, and you've done this before too, they rewatch those and reissue a grade. This seems like one that's going to get reissued, right?
Yeah, every Tuesday they do what's called a rescout. They have a second scout, you know, somebody different, which is smart. You know, like, you know, everybody kind of has different opinions on who did what and why and who's at fault. And so there's always a rescout. And typically, the grades change like a couple tenths, like nothing of note, really. There was one game, I can't remember it off the top of my head. I can go look it. I'll link it on our message board last year, like week 7, week 8. And the grades changed drastically on Tuesday with the rescout. I'm interested to see what the rescout looks like this week. I check it every week, and typically there's very little change, so I don't bother, you know, doing a big thing about it. Except for that one time where they really changed it. And I'm interested to see just what changes this time around.
Can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
New CBS Monday. NCIS is back.
We need all hands on deck.
So grab your gear.
NCIS!
And join our elite team.
What are the charges?
Murder.
New cases to be solved.
Double tap to the chest.
Same caliber as the murder weapon.
And new criminals to catch.
That's the bomb maker. Where's the bomb?
A new NCIS, Monday, 9, 8 central, on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.
Final question. I think we spent about 30 minutes on Luke Zoolander questions here, but final part of it. Does WVU have the big donor support willing to fund a buyout or structured buyout of Neil Brown and pay a new coach?
Yes. The better.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this when they announced the extension. I think you can go back and find this Country Roads Confidential podcast if we were recording at the time. I think we were. What you do not set that money unless you have the money, period. Like, you're not setting that buyout unless you have somebody who is agreeable to that buyout. You're not having the contract unless you have somebody who can pay the contract, all that stuff. So I think whatever dollar figures, no matter how high they seem, the money will be there.
Nice. It's a nice safety net. It sounds great for me to say that you do the business so you can do the business, right? Again, what good does it do you to have a $5,000 a month mortgage when you can only afford $2,500, right? Mm-hmm. Got this awesome house. Check out my crib. I'm out of here in 6 months, right? It doesn't work that way. And listen, you can get mad at me here if the buyout is what's keeping Neil Brown around for some time here. I'm not saying he's gone tomorrow, if not for the buyout. I do think that if this thing isn't so large, then the talks are probably a lot more advanced than they need to be, or than they are right now. Maybe they need to be too. I don't know. But if it's half, you're probably having much more serious conversations because it's much easier to overcome. But don't get mad at me if I say that you don't do this contract unless you can actually execute the contract. Because that's kind of utopian. I would like to think that somebody said, hey, here's the contract we have. And it goes upstairs to Stuart Hall, and then it goes around to some money people or whatever. And they say, well, you know, that's a steep buyout, but you know what? Go ahead. We got you. If someone said that's a steep buyout, do not do it, and they still went ahead and did it, then there's a whole bunch of flaws. And don't get mad at your local sports writer, right? But I would think that you would, if you are an athletic department, you're functioning in a way that says we're going to put forth this contract that we can actually execute if we have to, right? We're not going to paint ourselves into a corner with a bad coach or a bad program or whatever. You know, and this is not the same, but you put clauses in where you can fire coaches for NCAA violations or anything like that. Like, what makes them a fireable coach without having to pay him? Because you come to these forks in the road where you have to do something. And, well, we can't fire this guy because, you know, wait a minute, he broke NCAA rules. Yeah, we can't fire him. You don't have that written into your contract? Well, now you do. Right. So again, these contracts exist because when things happen, you just follow what the contract says. So my point being here that if you do got to fire him, all that buyout is what you agree to pay him. The can we, should we, will we, that should be taken care of already. Otherwise, it shouldn't be put in the contract and you shouldn't have signed it. And if in some time it becomes clear that they're not making a move because the number is too big, Chris, then you have to have some major conversations about the brain trust and the functionality here, because one problem is creating another problem, and that's a problem. So I would think that you have a foresight as an administration or as an athletic department to not contract yourself into a corner. So that's just me saying that. Is that reality? We'll see. I do think that if the number wasn't so large, you'd have a lot more aggressive conversations right now. The number being what it is, it lets us go on a little bit further. I'm sure it naturally instill some patience and maybe some more than people want to see right now, but that's just the reality of the situation. But I think it's in there because it's a number they can work with. It's a huge number, though, and how they get there, I'm not sure. We'll see. By the way, if they have to get there.
Yeah. Great segue, by the way, because the next question was from EarsFan03, which I think touches on this, and I had some thoughts related, but is it possible Lyons gets fired for the extension? How can he be trusted to replace Brown and potentially Huggins when he retires? And sorry to jump in here, but like, first, we need to separate the hiring and the extension, because first of all, you know, the decision came down to Luke Fickell and Neil Brown. For you can't say, oh, well, look, Luke Fickell made it to the college. It's different. He was still at Cincinnati. You know, what if West Virginia hired Luke Fickell and Neil Brown stayed at Troy? Is Troy still winning 10 games a year and Luke Fickell's going 6-6 at West Virginia? Are you then saying Neil Brown should have been the better hire? We don't know. So forget that part of it. The point being, the hiring part of this, two excellent choices at the time. Like, I think, and every single person I thought at the time, what a great hire. What a nice job, especially late in the game. Home run hire. It was universally approved of, this hire. And success, however moderate, seemed to indicate that it was the correct hire. Now, separate that from the extension, because even when the extension happened, you and I, again, on this podcast, had conversations about why. Why the extension? Why now? Why did you switch from, would you say it was 75% guaranteed on the buyout to 100% guaranteed on the buyout?
Mm-hmm.
Was that necessary? Why is this? And so separate out the hiring part of this and the extension part of this, because, hey, maybe you put Shane in charge of the hiring and then take the checkbook away when it comes to the extension part of it and let somebody else handle it. I'm not sure, because I think he made the right hire. At the time, it seemed like a great hire, a really great hire. And again, we're not shoveling dirt on things. Maybe it still ends up working out. Somehow they go on a crazy run here, but it was the right hire at the right time. He had two great candidates at the end. So he obviously, his list that he puts together is obviously a good list.
Yep. Had 4 years left. So it's not like he was, again, Lions, I'm not even sure, agrees with the idea that you recruit against the years not left in your contract. That was something that was kind of an issue when he was negotiating with the previous staff. Maybe he's changed on that. I'm not sure. But Neil Brown had years left. Four. They gave him two more. The Rays, probably the going market rate, I guess, for a coach who's going to be somewhere near what they expected. So that's okay. Some of the weird bonuses they put in there, incentives, retention bonus, whatever, small potato stuff. I think what probably arched brows was the fact that he was 100% salary if he was fired for the first 2 years, his initial contract. So 100% if he's fired for his first 2 years, 75% after 3, 4, and 5. And that was, and then again, if he's fired for the 6 year, the contract just expires. So when they gave him the extension, 100% for the first 4 years, 85 after the fifth. So a lot more money. Why? Don't know. Again, might have been the agent, might have been what Lions wants to do. I'm not sure. But I would say that Lions probably thought he was, to some extent, getting a discount. Let's get it done early before our head coach has leverage and this number is higher. Let's get him in here before the next South Carolina or Auburn back-to-back rumor mill whips up and maybe gobbles up your coach, and all of a sudden it's a weird month in recruiting, but he's still your coach because the buyout is... Actually, it's not hard for Brown to get out of the contracts. So that's not even a good argument. Point being that Lions did it because he believed in his decision, thought he probably was getting a discount, and then the buyout, I just don't know, I guess. We'll see. But I just don't think you do it unless you think you can get out of it. Again, it's a big number. It was a big number before. It just happens to be bigger now. And those are great questions that probably may one day have to be answered.
Again, as I do the math in my head, does it make a difference if the remainder of his buyout is, 12 million instead of 16 million? Because that's, 75% instead of the 16. After this year, is that what's going to make or break things for donors right now? That it's 16 instead of 12. Not sure, but
now if you're a donor though, you're probably not happy about having to kick in something to add up the $4 extra million though.
Right.
I don't think Lions would get fired for that, or should he get fired for that? Because again, the hire was seemingly correct. Ultimately, maybe not. But you put them in different cases. You just do. And the fact of the matter is, ADs can be wrong. They can. You hire a coach, he's going to end up on the side of the road sometimes, but you're going to have to let him get out back in the middle. An AD is probably similar, too. They're probably more problem solvers than coach ours in large regard.
Looking through the rest of the questions here, Seattle Mike, if you are listening, excellent question. I think we're going to turn that into a separate story. Really, really good question about, the history and the strategy of hiring a Power 5 level assistant or a Group of 5 head coach and what that is. He says he hasn't done the research. Well, you know what? Either Mike or I will, and we'll take a look at it because I'm interested in the answer as well. Don't want to answer it without proper research. Mike, was there anything else in here that you definitively wanted to answer right here on the podcast?
I would just try to, let me just address this stuff here too. Talking about replacements for me is not comfortable right now.
Yeah.
I understand that's what fans want to do. Cool, man, do it. I wouldn't even mind to chime in, like, if, hey, what do you think of so-and-so? Probably good coach, probably bad coach. Yeah, he's from Charleston, whatever. But I just can't get myself to fire Neil Brown at the moment right now, too. And that's probably not going to be popular to a lot of people here, but I just know there's a ton of time left. My hunch here is that they're not going to do anything here. And then you have a game they're going to win on Saturday, a game that they probably should win, or at least I shouldn't say should win, but should expect to go down there and compete in a couple of days later against Tech. I maintain that's going to be a challenge. And that might be, is that a referendum on Brown? Maybe, we'll see. But even then, if they're 1-3, or if they're 0-3, then he's done. Okay, let me say that.
Yes.
But if they're 1-3, I just don't know. I don't know that's going to happen in the middle of the season. There are conversations that are going to happen, I would imagine, and we can have them. But me going out there and putting out my wish list or a hot board or the this or that, or what's the candidate for a new coach, I'm sorry, it just feels difficult for me right now, because I just don't believe they're going to do anything at the moment right now. And it seems like a strange conversation to have, or to even hear me say that, because they're 0-10, lost to Kansas. But the fact is that, like, Pitt's a ranked team, was a ranked team. Kansas might be good. And all of a sudden, if they're 6-6 at the end of the season and Kansas is good and Pitt's there in the ACC again, it doesn't look so bad. And I just think that there's, like, a pragmatic element to this that decision makers are going to exercise. And that's just kind of like the breadcrumbs I follow right now.
Mike, are you trying to say that a message board shouldn't dictate what a school does?
I mean, except it does sometimes. So far be it for me to say that. There are some really good questions in there too. Like, I mean,
yeah,
some stuff about, like, hey, what's the quality of the next head coach? You know, personality, recruiting, motivation, you know, CEO or coordinator, group of five, power five. Those are really cool conversations. It's just difficult for me to do a whole lot on that right now because we're not there yet for me. I understand why they exist. I probably just can't shape them and construct them and contribute to them like people want me to.
I don't blame you. I think that it's going to be interesting these next couple of weeks, because I think, again, Towson, the only way it tells you anything or dictates what's going to happen is if West Virginia loses, which, I mean, hey, if West Virginia loses against Towson, you'll have a coaching hot board up by midnight.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I promise you guys. Now, 1-3 with a Tech loss, the seat will heat, and we'll be watching it. But again, it's still so early in the season. Like you said, what if Pitt's in the ACC championship again? What if Kansas ends up as like a 500 team, a bowl team? I think it's just the fact that you're saying they lost to Kansas, that's enough to drive some issues. And I mean, I don't blame anybody for being upset about it. I mean,
no.
It was a ridiculous loss. It was ridiculous. But what if Kansas ends up being decent? What if Pitt ends up being great?
Mm-hmm.
And then West Virginia wins 6 of their next 8. And they're sitting at 6-4. Like, then things are okay. And you're taking the next step. So we'll see.
The other part about this too, is that, like, if you look at the surroundings, and I wrote about this yesterday too, a lot of Big 12 teams have changed coaches since Neil Brown was here. Same year, same offseason, or since then. Find me one that's not in a better situation right now. Serious. Like, Kansas State? Better, right?
Yep, looking good.
Baylor?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. TCU?
Maybe.
Texas Tech, but like they're both 2-0, and Texas Tech just beat Houston, and is like the happiest program, not named Georgia probably right now. TCU won an identity, got their offense, did it. Baylor won the Big 12. Kansas State fits, right? Like, there's just a lot of things that you look around at the other schools that have made changes, and you're like, this worked. Why hasn't it worked here? I think that is something that you might measure Brown against the rest of the year. Like, wait a minute, these coaches who've been hired in the Big 12 since are doing better. How? Why? You know, harder job, parallel job. And then you could say it's not working here, but it can work somewhere else. It has worked somewhere else. That becomes an issue for sure. And again, like, you can argue with anybody. He had a bare cupboard. Oh, he had a tough transition. Maybe that's true. Not unique. Not unique. If you look at situations like at Kansas, right? Where's it harder than Kansas?
Right.
and they seem like they're doing pretty good. So again, you can stumble, can't stand the ground. So like these next couple of weeks, those are certainly proving ground games for Brown, his program, and his tenure.
Well, Mike, we aimed for 30 and are currently an hour.
All yeah, right. That's true. Important time, though.
Typical. Yep. Well, I am. We might have to hop here because I am currently talking with Robbie Martin, top in-state prospect for West Virginia, who was at the game. And I know people are going to think, oh, man, this was bad for recruiting. Guys still had a good time. Just a general reminder, and we'll end on a high note here. These recruits, they look at the big picture, one single game. I mean, again, they're going to look at the big picture about coaching staff, who's going to be here, when, job security. They think about that stuff, so that's going to be a factor moving forward. But there were some recruits, some important recruits that were on campus on Saturday night, and they witnessed that loss. I have yet to have one tell me, well, West Virginia sucks. I hated it. Okay. Yeah, they might not say that. Some of them actually would, but most of them enjoy the environment. They saw good things on offense. They want to see something out of the defense, and they still are very interested in WVU. So don't write everything off yet, especially with recruiting. Good things coming there, I think.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about the recruiting element here.
it's going to be interesting because that was another question that was in there that I think was worthy of us answering here on the pod. All your questions are worth us answering. Sorry. But that recruiting question was a good one because it's going to get weird. It's going to get very weird. And again, this is not something that we've had to deal with before.
Yeah.
Other schools have. Again, the only coaching change that has happened in the last 12 years happened after signing day on New Year's Eve and was over in 4 days. So there was only like two recruits that were kind of up in the air. The coaching changes before that, again, it was Bill Stewart, but Dana Holgerson had already been brought in as head coach in waiting. The one before that was after signing day again, close to signing day when Rich Rod left and Bill Stewart was able to step in and kind of keep things together. And that was almost kind of pre-focus. I mean, that was pre-me doing this but recruiting being so important or being such a thing online. So this is going to be new territory and it's going to get weird. So just be prepared for that.
Yeah, be prepared. Rations for your shelter. Coaching searches are not fun.
No.
But we're not there yet. Plenty of football left to play. Plenty of podcasts to discuss this topic. I'm sure we'll be here in depth, in detail, if and when it does happen. My name is Mike Casazza.
I'm Chris Anderson.
We'll talk to you next time.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.